Hey y'all, we have to talk about how ableism and racism are tied together in American history and culture. Intersectionality requires calling out and tackling all the isms, y'all. A good starting point for this discussion is slavery, which is why I'm talking to Professor Jennifer Barclay from the University of Buffalo about her book, The Mark of Slavery: Disability, Race, and Gender in Antebellum America. Ableism, like most harmful systems, is not the only way. It was a conscious effort to justify slavery by tying disability and blackness together and assuming both conditions to be subhuman. And the harmful legacy of that work continues to this day. So let's talk about disability during slavery and what it did to perceptions of both non-white and disabled folks. It's actually not that surprising that there would be a lot of disability in the history of slavery, just because slavery was like a brutal, like physically brutal system. You open the book just talking about like the many ways disability could manifest in slavery.
That was really important for me to sort of open the book that way, because I wanted people to recognize immediately, right? Like, we talk about the violence of slavery, but not really the sort of ways sometimes that people lived with the sort of consequences of that violence, right? That was sort of writ large on their bodies. And that happened in more ways than one. And, you know, when we think about disability as a sort of lived human experience, a lot of people are born with disabilities or can acquire disabilities with age or things like that. But for enslaved people, they also had, right, like disabilities that they acquired from punishments and from overwork and abuse and mothers, enslaved mothers, not having adequate diets. So they would give birth to babies sometimes that were born with congenital disabilities. Sometimes enslaved children, again, because of poor diets, would develop things like rickets and other conditions that could kind of lead to really serious lifelong physical disabilities and sometimes even cognitive disabilities, things like that. And then there were, of course, disabilities that people lived with because of diseases that they were exposed to, with various illnesses that we now have protection against, but folks didn't in the 19th century. So there were just a whole slew of ways that people in the 19th century in general, you know, acquired disabilities. But I think for enslaved people in particular, there were many other ways that we often sort of don't think about. Folks will sort of invoke disability sometimes, even scholars would sometimes mention it, kind of convey the brutality of slavery as an institution. But, you know, then just kind of dropped it at that point, right? And didn't really say a whole lot about like how people then experienced the rest of their lives with these disabling conditions and sort of what that meant for them, which wasn't always like, I don't want to say not always like a negative thing, but I mean, there were ways that people found to survive slavery with disabilities that allowed them to really contribute to their communities in important ways and to do all sorts of things, because slaveholders devalued them and saw them as kind of worthless and useless and whatever, because they had a whole set of assumptions about disability. Is sometimes, you know, the experience of disability and slavery meant that people did all sorts of important community-centered work. So a lot of times they were sort of respected. They were usually figures of stability within their communities because they were less likely to be sold. That was another sort of striking thing to me, was to think about the difference in how slaveholders perceived disabled enslaved people versus how like enslaved communities often perceived people with disabilities, because they were vastly different.
So I want to go back to some of the specifics. You talk about part of disability tied to slavery was that because Black people didn't like own themselves, medical testing could be a part of it. If you developed a disability and an owner was like, ooh, that's not great, they might just like deliver you to a doctor to do whatever, just to see if they could restore whatever happened. They weren't gentle with that.
The theory that I look at is the antebellum South, right? So from roughly 1820 to 1860. And this was a really pivotal time for American medicine. Like, medicine was kind of professionalizing and starting to become, right? Like, this sort of institution that we think of today when we think of medicine, you know, like the American Medical Association was established in the 1840s. And, you know, medicine was kind of taking off as a profession, but people were still really skeptical, I think, of medicine, of sort of what people referred to as regular physicians who would use various techniques. But a lot of times, like slaveholders, some of them would actually try to employ physicians to quote unquote correct the disabilities that they saw in slave people that they owned having. But sometimes a lot of them, like, also they didn't want to invest any money. And, you know, like, if they thought that a person was kind of, from their perspective, hopelessly disabled, then they would just kind of write them off. And that's that sort of moment where I feel like many enslaved people with disabilities, then they just kind of flew under the radar of slaveholders because they just kind of wrote them off and said, well, you know, and they would use this really harsh language, slaveholders would, like referring to people as useless. One thing that was really shocking to me was slaveholders sometimes referred to disabled enslaved people as chargeable. And what it meant for an enslaved person to be chargeable was that they actually had a negative value, like negative $200, meaning it cost the slaveholder money to provide care for that person that they couldn't recover through the person's labor. And it just, right, like that really highlights the kind of inhumanity, I think, of slavery and the ways that it just reduced people to these calculations, right, that you could just sort of look at a person's body and somehow ascribe a value to it based on how much labor you could squeeze out of a person. But that idea, right, from slaveholders that some people were just chargeable, like that really sort of solidified this idea that they were a quote unquote burden. Which is this rhetoric, I think, about disability is that it's really damaging ableist language, right? That somehow people with disabilities are burdens on society, on their families, in this case, right, from slaveholders' perspectives on them. And it really kind of reduces a person to nothing but, you know, this condition that they live with. So that certainly happened, I think, where sometimes slaveholders just, you know, didn't really care enough about enslaved people to try to acquire medical care for them. Sometimes, you know, there were examples where they did try to do that. And it was really, it was heart-wrenching in some ways. Like there was one child I wrote about, we don't know his name because I learned about him from reading like a medical journal. He was, you know, probably 12, 13 years old and he had vision problems. He was blind. And so the slaveholder sent him, this was a young man who lived in Virginia, and he was sent, you know, several hours away to another place in Virginia to go to a hospital to have surgery. And I remember reading that thinking like, and I wrote a little bit about this, just kind of imagining what that would have been like for him and for his family, right? To be separated from his family by many hours, taken away to some location where, you know, his family wouldn't have known really where he was going or what was happening to him, going through these sorts of painful operations to try to restore his sight and being gone for weeks and weeks at a time. I mean, it must have been, you know, horrifying for him and for, you know, his family. I think about his parents, you know, his loved ones. And then he was simply sort of returned to them and his sight wasn't restored, but it was like, oh, well, you know, like he received care, like, you know, and people checked in on him, but it was like, who provided the care, right? I remember thinking like, who provided care once he was taken back to his family? And there are all these questions that I had, but medical journals didn't always record that. Again, just kind of thinking about people as, you know, kind of medical specimens and sort of objectifying them in this very clinical way. But yeah, medicine was a really important place for me to look because I'm also interested in, and this is part of my work that's a little bit more difficult, I think, to explain sometimes. Like I'm interested in people's lived experiences of disability and slavery, but I'm also interested in the way that these categories of disability and race are sort of constructed alongside one another. And, you know, in the 19th century, like how, like to what extent was Blackness associated with disability, right? In these really ableist ways. And like, how was disability racialized? And you know, and I think that 19th century medicine had a lot to do with that. These incredibly racist medical sort of philosophies, like the work of people like Samuel Cartwright, for instance, who invented diseases like drapetomania. And he said, you know, oh, enslaved people, if they weren't disciplined properly or didn't have the right sort of management from the part of slaveholders and overseers and folks like that would be more likely to run away. And that this was actually like, he described it almost as like a mental illness, right? That it was like something defective or something, right? So he's creating these entire categories of diseases that are racialized, but they're also a reflection of disability. He was welding those two things together. To me, that's what I could see. Like I could see the way that disability was also operating in this sort of mid-19th century medical rhetoric. And it was really pervasive. Like this was something that physicians played a huge hand in, and that there were consequences of this and the legacy of that that has extended for decades and decades after the end of slavery.
Definitely. So you were talking about the way that like white perceptions of Black disability versus Black perceptions of disability were sometimes different. Once an owner saw their property as defective, sometimes they would even just send that person off because they didn't want to take care of them anymore. But one of the things you already said was that disabled people were pretty stable. They didn't often get sold. That was a like important community role, was just the stability in an institution where people could be sold off anytime. But also you talked about how in West African culture, disability was viewed differently.
Absolutely. I think like this is one of those things about disability that is really important to kind of clarify, which is that the ways that we think about disability, the way that we define disability, it's a category that changes a lot over time. Conditions or like things that people considered disabilities in the 19th century, like they're not even conditions that exist anymore, right? In the 19th century, people would talk about things like invalidism. Like nobody talks about invalidism anymore. Like that's not a, right? Like that's not a condition. In that sense, like disability is something that can change over time. Like what are things that we consider to be disabilities and why? But disability is something that can also change across cultures. So different cultures can have different perceptions of what are disabling conditions, and then what do those conditions mean? And like those meanings aren't always negative. I think in a lot of like the sort of what I would think of as the West, right? Like sort of the global North, ideas about disability are so shaped by the medical model of disability that says disability is a problem with an individual and that it needs to be quote unquote fixed through medicine, that medicine can cure disability and can make that person quote unquote normal, right? Like that's not the ways that people, even in the United States, for instance, have always thought about disability. Like that's something that emerged in the 19th century, but it's also not the ways that people historically in other cultures have thought about disability. And so I was really interested in kind of thinking, you know, about like this idea of African cultural retentions. And we know that enslaved people maintained a lot of cultural traditions. What sorts of ways did enslaved people or did, you know, did West Africans like before slavery began, like did they have a certain perception of the body and particularly of bodies that we would think of today as disabled? That were maybe different, right, in some ways. And that's exactly what I found when I started to sort of dig around. I found that, you know, in West Africa, granted, West Africa is incredibly diverse and there are a lot of different ethnic groups and a lot of different groups of people. But across many of those groups, like I found evidence that people with blindness, for instance, were perceived of as really spiritually powerful. The same with little people, folks who are dwarves, right, who are seen like who often held like positions in courts of like kings and queens, like these positions where they were considered valuable members of, you know, of the royal court. Folks who had other conditions, other kinds of phenomena, like Abiku children, you know, these were kids who were seen as born to die is kind of the thinking, right? And that their bodies would be marked if they died before they were buried so that when they were born again, their body would be marked when they were born and that their parents would know that child had returned, right? And to me, I was reading that thinking about disability, like, oh, that to me is like a reflection of congenital disability, right? A child that's born with some sort of physical anomaly, I guess people would say in the West, but who were seen as really spiritually powerful. So I think that, you know, my research, and this isn't like a ton of research in this direction, but I found evidence that in slave communities in the antebellum South, there were echoes of these sorts of really powerful ways of thinking about people with disabilities. One way that that really came through, and I love this example, is one of my favorite people that I write about. I looked at conjurers, right? So these were folks who were kind of spiritual healers. And a lot of conjurers were actually people who had disabilities. So their disabilities kind of played into the sort of sense that they had this spiritual power. And so one of my favorite people that I wrote about was a conjurer. His name was Dinky. And he was enslaved in St. Louis, and he was someone that William Wells Brown wrote about in his memoirs about slavery. And he talked about this man named Binky, who was blind in one eye, and right, like he really played up this like partial blindness, and like people thought that he could sort of see beyond, right, the here and now, that he had these special powers that were associated in part with his blindness. But people also described him, like some people would have said that he was, quote, full-blooded African. So he looked very, right, like people thought that he looked very African, and he would wear like these different sort of tools of his trade, like on his belt. So he would, you know, had snake skins and like all of these things that he would really prominently display, like on his body, to sort of play into this, right, like this idea that he was spiritually powerful. And, you know, what people said about him, they really respected him, and they were even afraid of him. And not just people within the slave community, but slaveholders and white folks, like in the larger community, were also really leery of Dinky. And I was shocked, because when I read about him, people said that he did what he wanted. He hunted when he wanted to hunt. He slept when he wanted to sleep. He traveled wherever he wanted to go, and nobody stopped him. And one guy said Dinky was his own master. And I was like, wow, right? Like, this was a guy who, like, people really respected and feared him. And, you know, and it was about a combination of things. It was about this sense that he was perceived of as being very African, but also that he had this blindness that allowed him to kind of see, right? It added to that aura that I think he very actively sort of cultivated. And he used this, you know, this as a form of resistance to do what he wanted to do without all of this, you know, kind of supervision and folks telling him what to do. And there was even one example of someone who said that they were going to discipline him. They were going to physically, like, try to whip him and make him more submissive or something, and took him into a barn, and a few minutes later came out and hadn't touched him, right? Like, and nobody said anything about it. Everybody just left. And, you know, but like those kinds of stories, I think, stuck within enslaved communities, right? We're like, well, hey, like somebody said they were going to do this to Dinky and they didn't, right? So it all kind of fed into, you know, that, again, this sort of powerful aura that I think surrounded him. And the same was true for other healers, enslaved healers, like women oftentimes, like who were herbalists, like herbal healers, who, like, I read about many women, a woman whose name was Aunt Darkest. They said that she was completely blind, but could go out into the woods and find whatever roots and herbs that she needed and wanted. Like, she could just see them. She could somehow sense they were there. And like, so it added to the sense of power that people within the slave community and sometimes outside of it sort of attributed to people. And it all sort of derived from the sense that they were different somehow because of their disabilities.
Yes, I think what's super interesting about this is that looking at disability through other cultures, it's just not like this Western lens. Ableism doesn't have to be the default. Disability doesn't have to be seen as like a disadvantage. That was kind of consciously done to prop up racism.
Absolutely. Yes, that's part of what I argue in my book, right, is that those things very much worked hand in hand. And, you know, and the same was even true, like in sort of colonial North America, even amongst, you know, Europeans who came to North America as colonizers and their descendants. Like, there were people with disabilities who they weren't viewed with this negative necessarily, like this, you know, oh, they're burdens, and right, like they were just kind of treated as regular people. And like, you know, like one of my favorite books is by Kim Nielsen. It's called A Disability History of the United States. And it's a wonderful book because she looks at the whole like sort of breadth of the United States. And she looks at colonial America. And I remember like one of the stories she told was about, this was a white man, but he had, you know, some sort of condition that people considered him to have, this sort of madness that, you know, every once in a while, like most of the time he wasn't living with it, but then sometimes he would have these episodes, right, where he would become manic or something. He would sort of lose touch with reality. And, you know, but people, they weren't afraid of him. They didn't think that he couldn't contribute to his community. In fact, he was a school teacher. And then if he had one of the episodes, the kids would just kind of lock him in the schoolhouse and leave, and they would tell someone so that people could drop off food and things that he needed until he was better. And then when he, you know, whenever he didn't have these episodes again, he would go back to being a teacher. And like, you know, to me, like when we think about that from our modern perspective, like it's hard to believe, right? But I think what it shows us, though, is that there's nothing about disability that historically has been set in stone, that has said, you know, oh, disabled people can't do these things or can't provide labor or can't do these things within their communities. Like a lot of disability is actually socially constructed, and it has to do with the perceptions and the beliefs that we ascribe to disability and the ways that, you know, we as a society believe and are told to believe certain things about it. And, you know, so I think that medical model of disability, like that I talked about earlier with the mid-19th century, with my medicine professionalizing, it created this medical model of disability that says, oh, well, medicine can fix disability and can correct it because there's something abnormal about someone with a disability, when in fact, it sort of created those conditions, you know, and it created that way of thinking about disability that's really problematic.
Yeah, let's get into it a little bit more. The way that part of legitimizing medicine in the 19th century was racism and ableism.
I was really interested in trying to think about the ways that racism and ableism kind of work together. And, you know, when I started, I immediately recognized the role that mid-19th century medicine sort of played in that, the ways that Southern physicians in particular, but even outside of the South, like there was still, you know, there were plenty of physicians in the North, in various places in Europe, who were sort of constructing ideas about race and Blackness in particular that linked it to these disparaging ideas about disability. And here I was sort of borrowing from like a really well-known disability historian is Douglas Bainton. And he wrote this really influential article called Disability and the Justification of Inequality in American History. And this article is about the ways that these disparaging ideas about disability, that disabled people are dependent or defective or abnormal or lacking, that those really disparaging ideas about disability could be linked to other categories like race and gender and immigration status or whatever as a way to justify treating groups of people unequally. So for instance, by linking women to, you know, saying that they're fragile physically and mentally, then therefore they shouldn't have the right to vote and citizenship rights. And by saying that Black folks, right, like had these innate disabilities and were somehow abnormal, then that also justified, you know, excluding them from citizenship or even freedom or even recognizing their humanity. And the same, he argued, was true for immigrants. I was, you know, really taken by that argument. And, you know, like I could see that argument very clearly in the work of 19th century Southern physicians, you know, who worked very hard to kind of link Blackness to disability, like in the work that they did. And it also was a reflection of they were in this very tenuous position themselves, like as like they wanted to be recognized as professionals, but medicine was just emerging as a professional field. So what they looked to was the law. And then, you know, they wanted to become experts in courtrooms where they could testify about, you know, the state of people's health and their mental health, their abilities and stuff like that. And within slave law, like that was really important because sometimes there were cases where folks would challenge the health and the soundness of a person perhaps that they bought and they would want to return. But this was really dehumanizing and a really gut-wrenching thing when you actually encounter it in the historical record. You find things like warranties. There were warranties when enslaved people were sold that warrants the health and soundness of their bodies and their minds. So if a slaveholder bought someone, took them, you know, back to the plantation and said, oh, well, they clearly have a disability that I didn't realize they had when I purchased them. So now I want to return them and get my money back. The same way that we would put a warranty right on a car or, you know, an object today that we buy. This was something that slaveholders regularly did whenever they bought and sold people. So, you know, what this meant, though, in a legal sense was that you needed groups of people like physicians who could go into the courtroom and testify and say, well, yes, this person clearly had this condition. Like this wasn't something that just happened yesterday, but was a condition that they must have been living with for several years before they were purchased. And then they could be these expert witnesses in cases like that. And so they really worked hard creating these narratives about Blackness and disability being linked together so that they could be experts over that discourse. So there was this relationship I saw between the law and medicine that really forged that connection between Blackness and disability. And so I looked at slave laws from colonial years, like all the way to antebellum America, and they were really brutal. So like even in the laws of slavery, like disability was pervasive, not just in terms of punishments, but when enslaved people were manumitted or freed, there were really strict manumission laws in the South, like when an owner could free someone. They were very concerned about the state of a person's body. Like, they didn't want slaveholders to manumit elderly, disabled, enslaved people who then the community would have to care for. So manumission laws were very stringent and said, oh, well, you can only manumit a person if they're above this age, but younger than this age, and they're able-bodied and they're sound-minded. And they had all these, like, you know, prerequisites for, you know, for freeing a person. And a lot of them hinged on, like, their actual physical and mental abilities. And if they were considered quote unquote sound. Even some other laws that, like I thought about these in a more kind of metaphorical way, but, you know, we talk often today about, when we think about the laws of slavery, about pass laws, for instance. Enslaved people would have to have a pass written so that they could travel. If they didn't have a pass, like from their owner or an overseer or someone, they could be punished for traveling without that. They couldn't testify in courts. They couldn't gain an education. And when I thought about metaphorically, like what those laws did, you know, they prevented people from moving freely. They were mobility impairments, or right, like they silenced people in the courts and made people unable to speak for themselves and on their own behalf. Like, so there's also this kind of disabling aspect of the law in that way. But there was definitely a relationship between the ways that slave laws operated and how disability functioned in them, and the ways that 19th century physicians were trying to kind of gain access into that legal realm as medical experts. And they really worked hard to kind of create this metaphorical sort of relationship between Blackness and disability that I think, you know, again, was something that we've lived with the consequences with for, you know, a long time after the end of slavery.
Yes, I want to come back to that. But two things you said about medicine. One thing in the book that you talk about a lot is like the concept of being unsound. And this work that like white medicine did was kind of to assume that all Black people were on their way to unsoundness. And it was just like a matter of where were they when a sale happened. And when you were talking about manumission laws and the way that like a Black person had to be able-bodied to be released, that just gets back to the way that being disabled was made to be assumed to be a burden. Like, if someone not able-bodied was free, they were going to be a burden, was the assumption. But I want to start getting into the hypervisibility of disability in arguments both for and against slavery. Which is wild that like both sides were hyper-focused on disability. But let's talk about the pro-slavery arguments first.
Absolutely. And that's actually a really great segue, like in terms of like thinking about pro-slavery arguments and the way that disability kind of rhetorically functioned in them, because it shows us like this immediate contradiction, right? So on the one hand, there were these manumission laws that said, oh, well, you know, you can't free an enslaved person unless they're over a certain age and under a certain age, and they're able-bodied and sound-minded, meaning they can labor for themselves. And then there were other things too, like that said a person would have to leave the state usually within so many weeks. And like, there were a lot of qualifiers to these manumission laws. But it's ironic that they even existed, because if you listen to the rhetoric of folks who were advocating for slavery, like politicians who were pro-slavery advocates, and they would use this rhetoric of disability to say, oh, well, benevolent slaveholders care about enslaved people. They care about their families, white and Black, and they'll provide care even when enslaved people get old and disabled and they can't take care of themselves. Unlike those free laborers in the North, like they're just like, once they can't work anymore in the North, like where they can't work for wages anymore, well, they're just on their own. Those companies don't care about them the way that slaveholders care about enslaved people. So it's like, really? Because like, you know, your laws don't really bear that out. Like, if that were true, then why would you need to pass laws that made it illegal to manumit someone whenever they were elderly and disabled and couldn't labor for you anymore? And even folks like Frederick Douglass, there's a really powerful discussion in his autobiographical writing where he talks about his grandmother, and he says that she was turned out to die when she became too old and too disabled to labor, that she was turned out to die in this little cabin in the woods all by herself. And he was enraged by that. You know, he was like, these, you know, the people who enslaved her made so much money off of her back, off of her labor, off of the children that she bore who became enslaved people. And right, like they made so much money off of her. But when she was elderly and becoming disabled, they turned her loose, right? They set her free and they just put her in this cabin in the woods to die because they didn't want to be responsible for her anymore. And, you know, Douglas also talked about this in relation to a young woman that he was enslaved with in Baltimore. Her name was Henrietta. And when she was enslaved as a girl, she was burned really badly in a fire. And he said that she lost the use of her hand and she could, you know, she really couldn't do very much, he said, except carry heavy burdens, like carry things that were heavy around, like that was like the most physical labor she was capable of. And he said, yeah, my master, my good master, he said, like sort of tongue in cheek and really sarcastic, he said he was always trying to give her away as a gift. He didn't see her value. He didn't think she was valuable because she couldn't labor for him. So my point, though, is that, you know, like the ways that these pro-slavery politicians talked about slaveholders being these benevolent, kind people who cared for, you know, they used disability as a way to really drive that home. You know, they were always saying, oh, well, poor elderly and disabled, or if they get hurt and become disabled, or if they're kids and they're born with disabilities, well, slavery will take, you know, slaveholders will take care of them under slavery, like they'll provide for them because it's a big family. They really sort of drew on that as a way to, like, this very sentimentalized way of talking about disability. And that's where I was, you know, if it's okay for me to sort of pivot to talk about abolitionists who, you know, were opposed to slavery, they did the same thing. They used disability in the same way, this really pitiful kind of specter of disability, but they just used it in a different way. They would say, oh, slavery should be abolished because enslaved people are becoming disabled all the time because slavery is so violent, which was true, but they really like played that up constantly, especially with enslaved mothers and their children. Like there was this whole genre of like abolitionist literature and songs and things like that, that were these really woeful, sad stories about enslaved mothers. Like, and they were sometimes like fictional, like these were just made up stories, but it was to show the brutalities of slavery. And like Harriet Beecher Stowe did this in Uncle Tom's Cabin, where she talked about an enslaved mother who two enslaved women whose children were sold away from them. And they were so, or they were about to be sold away from them. And they were just so tormented by being separated from their babies because their babies were disabled. Like one woman's child was blind and, you know, she was about to be sold away from her baby who was blind. So decided to grab her child and throw herself over the side of a steamship into a river and drown herself with her baby instead of being sold away. And, you know, the premise of that was it was largely because she was a mother and because her baby was blind and disabled and needed her. And, you know, so this was something Harriet Beecher Stowe like really emphasized, was like how disability like played a role in these narratives. And I mean, who wouldn't react to that emotionally, right? Like it's hard not to have an emotional response to that. But part of what I think the problem is with that is the way that it, again, always perpetuated this idea that disability was a negative thing, that disabled people were these pitiful sort of souls that needed protection and needed to be cared for. In fact, I feel like that's something abolitionists kind of dropped the ball on. I wish if they had challenged that a bit more and thought a little bit more deeply about the way that disability was used as this way to kind of disparage Blackness, like I think they probably could have done a lot more and been a lot more radical than they were. But there's this way that it's surprising that both pro-slavery advocates and abolitionists would use this language of disability as a way to kind of get sympathy and to get people on board with their causes that were so different. they were advocating for such different things, but disability, like the language of disability, was something that really sort of united their political rhetoric across the spectrum. So I was really intrigued by that. There were example after example of that I found. And I also found another way that both of these groups of people would use the language of disability was to disparage each other. So, you know, abolitionists would say, oh, these pro-slavery people, they're crazy, they're mad, like there's something wrong with them. They can't empathize with people. It means that, you know, they have some sort of problem, almost like they're disabled. They would call them mad and things like that. And like pro-slavery advocates would do the same thing to abolitionists. Like they would use the language of disability to sort of disparage them and put them down and say, oh, those abolitionists, like one of them referred to an abolitionist as an insane humanitarian, right? Like because how else to discredit someone than to call them crazy or mad? Or, and we still see that today. Like, that's a common insult, I think, that people try to trot out to kind of delegitimize someone, to say, oh, well, you're just crazy, or you just don't understand, you know, like, or you're stupid or something. And if you think about what that means, right, like what people are actually saying, like they're kind of using this language of disability and what's normal and not normal, and but they're using it as a weapon. They kind of weaponize it.
Yeah. But I want to wrap it up by looking at the legacy, because this work that was done during slavery didn't just dissolve at the end of slavery. It has a legacy that went right into the like immediately post-emancipation period, but like that we still kind of feel today.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of complexities, I think, to this legacy. There's certainly the relationship between racism and ableism that I think endured. To me, one of the most obvious places to see this is in medicine, right? Medical racism that continues to exist today. And for instance, the idea that, I don't know, Black folks are less likely to experience pain in the same way that white people are, or right? Like, it, to me, that this is rooted in like differences of the body in different ways, right? And like, I think one really recent example that stood out to me, and this is, you know, it's a really disturbing example, but this happened during COVID. There was a man in his mid-40s from Texas who was quadriplegic. He had had a heart attack a couple of years before that that had left him paralyzed. And so he had medical issues, right? And was paralyzed. But he was married. He had 5 children. And he contracted COVID and was admitted to the hospital in June of 2020. His name was Michael Hickson. And the doctors chose not to give him life-saving care for COVID because he was disabled. But, you know, he was also Black. So it's like, to what extent did, right, like racism and ableism kind of come together in this man's life? And, you know, he died. He was moved to the hospice floor and he didn't receive food or fluids for 6 days. And he only received pain medication and a medication for anxiety. And his wife recorded a conversation that she had with ICU doctors about her husband's care. And when she asked them why they were making these decisions to withhold care, the doctor said it was because of his quality of life. And this is a quote. One of them said, as of right now, his quality of life, he doesn't have much of one. Because they assumed, right, that because he was quadriplegic and because, you know, they just assumed that he didn't have much of a quality of life. But to me, I hear a story about a man, right, who was loved by his wife, by his 5 children. He clearly had a full life. Like, what's making a whole set of assumptions about what to do with his life on his behalf that was made by medical professionals. And I know there was a court case that was filed. I don't really know the resolution of that, like what happened as a result of that. But to me, when I read about things like that, clearly about ableism in the sense that because this man was paraplegic, he didn't have, you know, a life supposedly worth living. But I also question how much racism had to do with that. If he had been a white man who was paraplegic with 5 kids and a wife who was asking about him, would physicians have been so quick, right, to make that decision and to make that case? So I think that there are really like powerful and deadly ways that we live with this legacy, and we have to think about this relationship between racism and ableism. I think it's really critically important. And it's also important, I think, to talk in some ways about how like ableism can sometimes influence like social justice work, even like historically, like within the Black community. Like when we think about civil rights organizing and things like that, there often wasn't an emphasis on the needs of Black folks with disabilities. My next book, I'm really interested in looking at schools that were doubly segregated for Black kids who were blind or deaf in the South. And some of these schools, like the last one to integrate, was not until 1978. Yes, so that's really late. And, you know, and there's some really cool work on, you know, like the work of the Black Panthers, for instance, and their support of disability rights and the rights of, you know, disabled Panthers. And like, especially in San Francisco, like the 504 sit-ins, and like, there's really cool stuff. So I think in some ways, there were groups like the Panthers that were really forward thinking, even in the 1970s, and kind of asking questions about disability and race and the ways that ableism and racism work together. But I think across the board, you know, anyone who's interested in social justice and equality and equity, like really need to think about how this disability kind of intersect with racism, with gender, with homophobia, with other kinds of oppression and inequity that exist, because it's usually there and, you know, it's oftentimes overlooked. So, but there are a lot of great folks who are doing a lot of really important work on this today. So hopefully that trend continues. And, but to me, that's still part of this legacy. It's part of this legacy, again, of thinking about Black folks with disabilities and just people of color writ large with disabilities as sometimes being hyper-visible, but often being invisible too.
Yeah, wow. One, that story makes you really angry. But that's a good way to wrap it up. That ableism is one of the isms that we have to attack and dismantle as part of intersectionality.
Absolutely. And if we don't acknowledge that, how much work are we actually doing, right? One story, I often use this in class. Someone, a professor, told me this when I was a master's student, and it's always stuck with me. You know, she said, if we live in a world where racism exists, and we live in a world where sexism exists, and we live in a world where classism exists and ableism, because all of those things hold each other up. So if we only tackle one of them, or we only tackle two of them, and we ignore the others, right, then we're not actually changing the system, the structures that kind of hold these things up. Like, we have to think about them as being deeply entangled with one another, and we can't ignore certain things just because maybe it's inconvenient, or it's not something that we think about, or it's not something that's part of our lives personally right in that moment, you know? And I feel like that's kind of what happens with disability and ableism sometimes. But as disability scholars have said and activists have said back in the 80s or 90s or whatever, they used to use this phrase TABS, and that stood for the temporarily able body. Because if there's one thing that all people share, it's the fact that probably all of us, if we live long enough, will become disabled. So we should remember that, right? Even if we are young and non-disabled, or, you know, like, there's probably going to be a time when disability, like, will play a really immediate role in our own individual lives. So we should be thinking about those things, even if we're non-disabled.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. This was really fun. It was good to talk with you.
Thanks for listening. Keep telling people about this show. Keep challenging the harmful systems around you. And follow me on Facebook and Instagram @WeTheBlackPeoplePod. All power to all people, y'all.